All right. You know, we always enjoy having authors on, and I know the fans really take to these books, and they're great stories. They're great parts of baseball history and the history of the world, and we have one on today, which I think is just outstanding. It's called Last Seasons in Havana. So you can imagine this and where this goes back to. It's written by Cesar Brioso. And Cesar is in Miami. He's worked for the Miami Herald and other newspapers down there. USA Today Sports, a baseball editor, and has really, really put a great book together on the history of baseball in Havana. Cesar, nice to have you with us.
Hey, Marty, glad to be with you.
Yeah, I see you worked with USA Today Sports. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's where I am now. We're based just outside Washington, D.C.
Ah, very good. You must know Paul White then, right?
Oh, yeah. He's no longer working with us, unfortunately, but yeah, I knew him for several years.
Yeah, Paul's on tonight. He'll be on in about 40 minutes or so, somewhere in that range. But I love the book. I grew up in South Florida. So the story of Havana baseball, there's a story that of course, is a great tradition and how it all started there. But then it came to sort of a climax in the 50s. A lot of changes, but the International League team became a team, the Sugar Kings. So tell us about why you chose this and a little bit about the story, because I think the fans would really find it interesting.
Well, primarily, you know, I was born in Cuba. My family came here when I was 5 months old. But my dad, when he grew up in Cuba, in Havana, he was a fan of Almendares, one of the four teams in the Cuban Winter League. And when I was a kid, he would tell me all these stories about American ballplayers who would come there in the winter to play in the Cuban League. Tom Lasorda, Monty Irvin, Ray Dandridge, all these guys went on to Hall of Fame careers. And eventually I ended up writing the first book, which was Havana Hardball, which dealt with the 40s, about the same time when Jackie Robinson and the Dodgers trained in Havana right before he broke baseball's color barrier. And the second book, Last Seasons in Havana, picks up where that one left off. It's the 50s. The Cuban League has been brought into organized baseball. So now there's a system in place for teams in that league signing players from the United States. As you mentioned, there's minor league baseball in Havana. Havana Cubans of the Florida International League had moved into the International League as the Havana Sugar Kings. And also the Sugar Kings owner, Bobby Maluto, had hoped to bring potentially an expansion team to Havana. So that was the atmosphere in the 50s when Fidel Castro began his revolution, and eventually everything would, as far as professional baseball, would fall apart in the early 60s.
Well, what would you like people to take away after reading the book? What would your message be?
Well, I guess just the really long-standing baseball ties between the U.S. and Cuba. They go back all the way to really, in terms of baseball, 1878 was when the Cuban League was founded, just 2 years after the formation of the National League. As early as 1890, teams from the U.S. started to go down there. There was one with John McGraw. He was a player at the time, came down there, sort of an all-star team barnstorming. And then in the early part of the 20th century, you had Negro League teams coming down there to barnstorm. You had teams in the offseason like the Philadelphia A's, the Detroit Tigers, the New York Giants would come down there and play games, make some extra money. And, of course, individual players were playing in the Cuban League all that time. And you started to see in 1911 the first two Cuban players in the modern era. The Reds signed them. And so there was this exchange of talent for decades, before things got cut off completely in 1961, and basically we went, 5 decades without any players from Cuba getting a chance to play in the majors. So just how deep the ties between the two countries as far as baseball run, I think, would be the main message that I would want to get across.
No, it's great on the timeline. Then you have the gap, and, of course, then we see now the players coming from Cuba again. So I get it. I understand that. But you go back to the 40s during World War II, and the Washington Senators always had that link through Papa Joe Cambria. They brought up Cuban players and put them in Minneapolis and had them playing there in the 40s. And, of course, Washington seemed to have more of the Cuban players in the 50s.
Yeah, Joe Cambria supposedly signed something like 300 to 400 Cuban players beginning in the 1930s. He was working for the Washington Senators for many years, so a lot of those players got to the Washington Senators, or at least into the Senators' farm system. And then, yes, when the Senators moved to Minneapolis, you know, those players were there with them, such as Camilo Pascual, Pedro Ramos, and then eventually you saw you know, Tony Oliva is another player, although he never got the chance to play in the Cuban League because his career started just as everything was falling apart in Cuba.
I've had a couple of people on the show who played in Havana when Castro took over, and the soldiers coming, you know, to the ballpark, and Castro coming to the ballpark and coming in the clubhouse. Johnny James, who pitched for the Richmond Virginians in those days at the Yankee Farm Club. I remember interviewing him about it. There are legendary stories about Castro and baseball, and I guess baseball hung on a little bit with Castro there until things really clamped down.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a slow motion toward the end. You know, that first year, 1959, you know, Castro was supporting baseball down there. You know, he would show up at games, throw out the opening pitch, certainly using it as sort of propaganda for the new regime. But, you know, things started to turn as relations between the U.S. and Cuba started to turn. There were a lot of fears that Cuba was going to communism, which indeed happened. And then on the field one time in July 1959, the Rochester Red Wings were in town for a series in July, and it was the anniversary of the start of his movement. The 26th of July movement was what the revolution was named. And they were playing a game late at night. It went into extra innings, and when the clock struck midnight and it was the 26th of July, soldiers and other people celebrating started firing off weapons, and stray bullets ended up striking two players on the field. Leo Cardenas, who was with the Sugar Kings, a shortstop, he was grazed in the shoulder, and Frank Verde, at that point he was coaching the third base box because the manager had been tossed, and he used to wear a plastic liner in his cap, which probably is what saved him. He got grazed in the head. The game was canceled. The Red Wings refused to make up the game or play the scheduled game the next day and left the island. You know, the Cuban officials were able to convince the International League that it was an isolated incident, and the season continued on. But certainly that was where a lot of the fears as far as the International League and organized baseball as to player safety started. And things just kind of deteriorated as the relation between the two countries deteriorated, and eventually the Sugar Kings in 1960, mid-season, were relocated by Frank Shaughnessy, the International League president, to Jersey City during a road trip. And the move was so quick that when they got there, when they debuted in Jersey City, they still had their Sugar Kings uniforms. Mm. And instead of the red script that said Cubanos across the chest, you can see in photos that they had to sew over a patch that said Jersey City.
Okay.
Now, they managed somehow to get caps with JC on them, but that's how they made their debut after being forced to leave Havana mid-season in 1960.
Well, I remember it because I was in Miami then, because, you know, I saw him play against the Miami Marlins at Bobby Maduro Stadium, which eventually became known as Miami Stadium. But I remember him quite well. Last Seasons in Havana is the book. It really is good, as you could tell. Cesar knows his stuff. Cesar Brioso, B-R-I-O-S-O. We have the book up at the Book Tree in Montclair. I'm sure you get it on Amazon and all the other places. It's out in Nebraska University Press. How's it doing?
Well, I haven't gotten my first statement yet, but I've been doing a bunch of events, book signings and such, and they seem to have been going well, so I'm really curious to see how the sales are going.
Yeah, it's a great story, the connection of the United States, the military, baseball in Cuba and everything else, and through the different political regimes, baseball still had its spot. Isn't that funny?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Baseball in Cuba withstood a whole bunch of changes and turmoil down there, and it was finally the Castro Revolution that at least put an end to the professional side of it. Obviously, baseball continued there as an amateur, you know, state-run kind of program, just like all the athletics in Cuba, the kind of like you would see in the Soviet era during the Olympics. That sort of system is still in place in Cuba now. But, yes, baseball has thrived there for many decades, despite the political turmoil.
Aaron, well, the last piece of history, of course, the Dodgers trained down there, as you said, with Jackie Robinson, because they couldn't go to Florida because of the segregation, and Jackie was part of the team in the 47. And Leo Durocher made that comment, or someone said something about the Yankees, Larry McPhail, having gamblers in his box in Havana. And McPhail got upset about it and complained to Happy Chandler. Next thing you knew, Leo Durocher was suspended for a year, and all that came out of Cuba.
That's right. Like you said, the Dodgers were down there. They actually trained down in Cuba several times in 1941, 1942, and then again 47 when Branch Rickey was planning on having Robinson break the color barrier, and he didn't want to deal with what they had to deal with in spring training in 46 in the Daytona Beach area with Jackie Robinson there with the Montreal Royals. So he moved the entire base of operations to Havana for the spring of 1947. And the games that determined whether Jackie Robinson would be promoted all happened mostly in Havana. They had a slight side trip to Panama as well. But yes, the suspension, Durocher actually had to leave Havana to come to Florida for the hearings with Happy Chandler before he was eventually suspended right before the season.
Yeah, he had the big walk at the Claremont Hotel and near the golf course around the Claremont. That's where he met Happy Chandler for his dressing down, so to speak, and then things went from there. Hey, the book is terrific. I enjoy it. Last Seasons in Havana, and we love having you on. You're welcome anytime, and look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you so much, Mario. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, Last Seasons in Havana, the Castro Revolution and the End of Professional Baseball in Cuba. It's a great, great, easy read about that history. Cesar Brioso, Brioso. All right, more coming up right after this.